Webinar, just a few seconds early, as we hoping to start right on top of the hour, but welcome. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of the broad topic of, well, how do you tell how long something's going to last? Life estimation, and there's lots of different names for what we do here. Yet I've often believed that reliability engineering is among all kinds of different things that we do and all the different methods that we have available, one of the most common things we face is, will this design last long enough? Will it meet the warranty period? Will it meet the customer's expectation? Will it survive? And the other one was then, how will it fail? And of course, those two are related. And so the more we do to provide feedback to the design team saying, you know, we just figured out that this will break this way and it's really not going to last very long, they get timed and you know, focused to then go improve that part of the design, improve that system. Where we run into trouble, though, is that life estimation in and of itself is difficult. And we'll explore that in a bit more here. So let me see if I can get screen to go along. So a very common question I've heard, and it was the very first question I heard when I didn't even know there was such a thing as reliability engineering. I was working in an R&D role and had a experience with our product and a bunch of statistics. Yet I'd never been asked this question before. My director came over and said, hey, we need to know how long this new product will last when it's buried in concrete and the customer won't buy it unless it's clear that there's good evidence that it'll last for 20 years. So, okay. Do I get 20 years, maybe a little extra to go figure out if it will last that long? And he goes, no, you have 6 months. And I said, okay, let me go figure out how to do this. So went to the library, found Wayne Nelson's book on accelerated testing and was able to create a test plan and had plenty of samples. We had chambers and our product was a chemical degradation process due to oxidation and we sorted it out and provided the work with the customer so they understood how we were testing it and how we did all our work. And we were able to answer the question that a significant percentage of the products would happily last for 20 years. And they had the advantage of also being in a relatively cool part of the world, up at altitude in the mountains in northern Italy. So it probably would last even longer in those conditions. We didn't apply how much oxygen would be getting to the product via when it's encased in concrete. I just thought of that. That's 30 years ago. I should have sorted out that may have inhibited the oxygen or made it worse. It's hard to say. Maybe that's why we didn't follow it up. The other one is, when will it fail? And we're interested in putting a pump on a production line and we need to know when to replace it or repair it or maintain it. And we want to do that before it fails. And so if we know when it will fail, if we can monitor that or detect that onset of it, that failure, that's another way we can go about doing these things. And it's a variant of the same question, how long will this last? And if question implies without failure, then these two are obviously related. But we also want to answer this question oftentimes for a maintainable system. Well, when do we need to add lubrication? When do we need to replace a gearbox, for example? How long before? And it's more of a question in the design process for the cost of ownership and that kind of realm of it. But also, what is the supply chain? What's the setup and who's going to do it and how do we do it? And once we know how often we have to maintain something in order to preserve its availability, for example, then that's a related question to what's the life estimate for this product. In some industries, this is related to, we have a 12-hour flight mission for this aircraft. It's got to be able to survive for 12 hours airborne. And also, because of the cost of the asset, it needs to be able to do repeated 12-hour flights over so much time, whether it's 5 years or 20 years. And so we get this question, this life estimation is one of the sets of tools that we want to apply in many, many different ways and many different scenarios and app and formats within our particular industry. And so it's a common question, and there's no one way to answer it. And that's really what I want to go after today is when you first get this style of question, well, what do you do? And we'll obviously get more into that. And so here's more of a rhetorical question for you. Is it sitting here right now, do you really know how long your product will last? Is the whatever widgets or systems you've got in front of you, do we ever really know that it will last for, say, 100 days plus an hour, and then it will fail? Now, we might know that that's when it's going to be decommissioned, and there might be some variability around that. Yet we may know that this is going to run for 2 weeks and it's going to be down, and we can do maintenance, repair, or replace it. But we rarely know of all of the thousands of ways that, say, my computer, I'm going to knock on wood here, hopefully it's not going to demonstrate one of its failure modes here, has so many thousands of ways it can fail. And they're all competing to cause whatever it is they cause to occur, whether it's a blank screen or a reset or just won't fire up or loss of power or whatever. And it's a random process, as Chris Jackson would often say. It's not a constant hazard rate. There's all these different mechanisms at play. And there's increasing degradation in different parts of the system. There's diffusion happening, there's corrosion happening. And eventually one of them wins and takes the system down. And it reminds me of I was in a box store and had my HP shirt on. It had a logo, HP logo on it. So apparently that and my Dockers pants made me look like an HP engineer of some sort. And so this woman was in the printer aisle of all these boxes, and she looked at me and says, "Do you work for HP?" And I says, "Yes, I do." And I says, "I actually work on these type of printers right here." And she said, "Well, I really want one of these printers, and there's four boxes here, all of the same exact model." And she says, "Could you pick out a box that will give me a printer that will last for 5 years?" And I'm like, I really don't know which of those four boxes is guaranteed to last for 4 or 5 years. I'm fairly certain that any of them will last for 5 years, yet it's a probability thing. And at that point, she just said, "Well, could you help me put it on my cart?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And so I helped her move this box over under her shopping cart, and off she went. And it was one of those perceptions of, well, whether I'm getting into a car or buying an ink or buying an ink pen of some sort, I really don't know how long it's going to last. And I think even as a reliability or engineer and all the work we do to estimate life, we have a pretty good idea that some percentage of the units will survive for a particular amount of time based on all kinds of different information that we can have at our access or that we have available. And the idea is that we can uncover the uncertainty, we can peel back our what we don't know and get a clearer picture of how it's going to fail and when it's going to fail or how long it will last. Yet at the end of the day, we don't ever really know. It's completely different than the criteria and the requirements document says it has to weigh less than 10 kilograms. Well, we can take our unit and put it on a scale and measure it. And we know exactly whether it's there or not, or plus or minus the measurement error of our system. Yet reliability estimation, life estimation, isn't in an exact science by any means. We'll explore a handful of ways so we can get at it. And it's one way to say it is that it's difficult. And I talked about it. I had 6 months to figure out whether this product we were working on was a 20-year product or not. Not only did I not know how to do that, it gave me an opportunity to go learn this stuff and apply some of the statistics and regression analysis and things like that I knew. Yet, at the end of the day, it was convincing enough for this company to buy our product and install it in these bridges on the roads in the Alps. And the intent was to keep ice from forming on the bridges. And it actually worked out pretty well. I actually got to drive in the Alps in the winter and see that the bridges were clear. Now, I only was assuming that it was our product in there that I'd worked on so many years prior. But the idea is that unless you have a time machine and can hop and the customer says, yeah, we'll use it, it's really hard to know if it's going to survive for 20 years or not. There's a whole lot of trust going on here. And so, in doing accelerated testing in particular, in whatever various many forms it takes, is that we're trying to cheat time. We're trying to peer forward into some way that this thing fails and accelerate that, and say in a chemistry, a chemical process is using temperature usually to accelerate it. It allows us to speed the clock up for that failure mechanism. And I count that as cheating time. It's not really, if we're doing it well, it's the exact same failure mechanism, same phenomena that occurs, only we're creating a stress that's higher than what it would see in normal life and in its normal environment. And that allows us to essentially speed the clock up. Now, some things we can do that with. Chemical processes is probably the most famous one. Yet, like a car door, you can open and close that car door more often than is commonly done on on your passenger vehicle at home. And so you can accelerate the number of opening and closings that thing does. But some things we just can't accelerate. There's a forklift driving into a pallet of inkjet printers. Doesn't make much sense to accelerate it by driving into it faster. It might cause more damage, yet a forklift fork going through a printer causes enough damage that it's not going to be useful. We can't sell that one. Yet there's not really a way to accelerate that. Some things are very difficult to accelerate, like dropping. Getting the shock and vibration that goes onto it. Yeah, we can accelerate it by dropping it more often or from a higher distance. Yet at some point, the amount of stress that's applied changes how it fails. Instead of initiating cracks and propagating the cracks, it just shatters it completely. It overstresses it and just rips it apart. So we have limits, even with temperatures, is if you have a polymer system in your product, there's a limit, or most metals have a limit to how high of a temperature you can go before it just melts. It has a phase change, which is not to be expected in most products in the field. And some failures are time dependent and some aren't, like the forklift. It's not time dependent. It was in the wrong place at the right time, or at the wrong time, I guess. I never really understood that. But time is a barrier for us. Unless we're very creative and understand the failure mechanism. And I'll come back to that understanding piece many times. The fundamental piece here is, and I had somebody once ask me, it was a portable printer, and they said, can you tell how long this will last? And in the transfer from him to me in the office of handing this small printer to me, the best I can say is we dropped it. I didn't drop it on purpose, but we dropped it. And it dropped about 3 feet onto the floor and it broke. And I said, it'll last about 3 feet, which isn't very good for a portable device. And I don't expect people to drop a printer, yet they will. And whether it's on the box and shipping, or if it's pulled off the desk or falls off your car seat. And at the whole system level, though, I'm looking at this printer saying, do you want the electrical failure mechanisms, the mechanical failure mechanisms, the software failure mechanisms? Of which of those three broad categories, there's probably 1,000 of each. And which mechanism is most important to you, or which handful of mechanisms is most important to you? And how does it actually work? How does it actually manifest itself? And what kind of symptoms can we get? Is it a cumulative damage type issue, or is it a just overstress for like that drop of 3 feet? Because we almost always have to focus on a specific mechanism in order to evaluate the life of it. Now, let's see, I can see a question here from Brian. Yeah, even something as simple as taking out the unused time can result in higher operating temperatures, maybe change the failure mechanisms. Yeah, bearings, lubricants, etc. Car doors. If you open and close the car door fast enough, it will heat up. The classic example is a toaster. If you make one slice of bread turned into toast, one right after another thing, it will last a long, long time because it's not cooling off. And it's that thermal cycling that damages the connection between the nichrome wire that creates the heat and its electrical source. Where if you keep it very hot, it has very little thermal cycling effects on it and it'll last a long time. So with every single way that your product can fail, some are going to dominate. Some are going to be known that that's the most likely way it's going to fail. Or like in Brian's questions, you might have a specific phenomena or feature, say on that inkjet printer, opening and closing the door for the scanner, or opening and closing the door to replace ink. We don't replace ink cartridges every day. Imagine there's somebody that prints enough that they would. Yet the idea is that we probably have an idea of how often somebody's going to open and close a door, or manipulate a hinge, or power up the device. Some products will get powered up multiple times. Some get battery charges every day. Some those kinds of phenomena, then we could just do it more often. If, as Brian points out, we understand the mechanism well enough that we don't alter it too far away from its actual use conditions. So opening and closing a car door, we have to do it slow enough that it's a relative force of what a human would do. The hard part is doing it randomly, like a human would do. A 100-pound person will close the door with a different force than a 250-pound person. And although there's going to be variability in that, a door slam is different than a gentle close, and a gentle close may not latch. Is that a failure or not? So, understanding the mechanisms, whether it's wear, chemistry, or creep, or whatever, is essential for us to do a life estimate. It's not just take the whole box and put it in a chamber and hope it works at the end of the day. We're accelerating some mechanisms through temperature, yet the manipulation of hinges is not being exercised, no wear is being accumulated when we just increase the temperature. So I always start with you got to understand the mechanism so that you know what stresses to apply and how much stress to apply. And is there a way to translate that stress being applied back to normal conditions? And so I see too many standards and too many people just say, oh, just apply 85 C for a week and that's your life test. And I'm like, no, that's not. That's just putting it in a chamber at 85 C and hope it has anything, something relevant will happen to your product that you can understand. Yet if it comes out and doesn't fail, unless you know there's a temperature-related mechanism that 85C is accelerating, you really can't translate that test into this product will last for 10 years. Because the temperature probably will not be exciting much of the to do with your software systems. It may change timing, it may not. Yet I should do a whole webinar just on mechanisms because I about to get on my soapbox here for this one. You really, really need to understand how a element fails before you try to estimate how long it's going to last. The other part we have is that if you take a look at that whole box of whatever that is that the system is that you're making, is we don't, in some cases, we really don't know how it's going to fail. We don't know of the hundreds of ways it could fail, which one will be the dominant one, which will be the Achilles heel for this system. And when you're lucky like that, then doing HALT or FMEAs is a way to peel back your understanding to get at, well, what are the mechanisms at play here? What are the likely things that cause this to fail? I hope you can't hear that. There seems to be a woodpecker on the side of the house. Sounds like knocking on the door. But the idea is there's a whole lot of ways a product can fail that sometimes we just don't know. And that really hampers us from estimating how long it'll last because we don't know how it will fail. We don't know what mechanisms at play. Now we can assume a mechanism or two and what wishful thinking go with that. Thanks, Bert. So apparently that background noise isn't too bad. So the idea here is that if we don't really know how this product is failing, doing a life estimate or how, what mechanisms are at play or of concern or dominant of concern, there's still a chance that we need to figure that out before we move forward. So HALT and FMEA are great ways to do that. Other times we may believe, based on field data and so on, here's the three ways that this is likely to fail. Let's use that as the basis for our life estimates. What is something else is there that we hadn't addressed before? Or there was a subtle change in the process, or there was a di difference in material we used, or some other latent defect got introduced. If we're unaware of those things, then our basis for life estimate based on what we know and we're focusing on will be invalid because we didn't take into account what we didn't know. And I've seen teams where they'll do an accelerated life test, say on solder joints, and then they'll cut the estimate in half to account for all of the uncertainties of running that life test. So there's a handful of different ways that we can go about doing this. Yet the more we know about how it fails, the better for creating an estimate. All right. So before I get into some of the various methods that I wanted to bring up and talk about good and bad and so on, how do you do that? I've been yakking away here. Apparently the woodpecker decided that our siding is not a good place to put acorns in it today. So they moved off. That's good. Otherwise the life estimate for that woodpecker would have gone down. Although I don't think my neighbors would appreciate a shotgun going off in the neighborhood. But how do you do estimates of how long your product or system or component will last? Yep, Brian's doing Y bays, and that's an efficient way to do it. If you have a pretty good understanding of the failure mechanism, the model of the shape of the Weibull distribution, I think it's shape, the beta value, then you don't need a lot of samples to confirm that you're on that track or better or you're worse. And you can use that as a reasonable way to do it. I agree with that. Yeah. similar to a heritage product. So we've been making something for 4 or 5 years, and we get field returns or some information back from our customers. And we know how it works in that field. And we're going to use, say, that power supply in a new product and say, oh, okay, that's cool. Let's use that. And you can build off of your field data or your, it's similar to other ones. And I agree, D'Angelo, there's lots of assumptions there. And that's where it gets tricky, but it is a common practice. NPRD, I'm, Laura, I really hope you have other methods and techniques to confirm what you're getting out of a database. There's all kinds of problems with the approach of using tabulated data. And especially when it's not specific to your environment, your product, your customers. It gets too far away from relevant to what you're doing. So it's one of the methods I highly discourage. Yeah, it's quick, it's easy, it's not too expensive, yet the results are little more than a random number. So a lot more to be said about that one. Warranty data. Yeah. If you've got an ongoing product and you're doing continuous improvement, looking at your field data, warranty data is great. Warranty data often isn't long enough, though. And if you really want to know if your product lasts well beyond your warranty period, like we do with inkjet printers, the warranty, I think, is 2 years on them. Yet I know from the design criteria that we want them to go at least 5 years or longer because you'll buy ink and that's where the money is. It's the razor blade type business model. So we want the hardware to last a good long time so that you continue to buy ink from the same brand. Hopefully that all works out. But the idea is that sometimes the warranty might be 6 months, but we really know customers want to use this product for 10 years. And whatever industry, and we don't do long warranties, that's reasonable in some business sets. Yet we want to go beyond that. Instead of estimating like BLife or L10, those kinds of things, we demonstrate reliability, calculated as combination of inherited reliability and testing. Yeah, there's a blending of techniques there. I don't much care for B10 or L10 type stuff or averages or B1 or whatever. Much prefer getting the whole distribution if you can. It's a whole lot more meaningful for everybody involved, but that's it. Yeah. And Laura, if you have good company data, say for, and I worked with one team that had really good information on their field returns and the life of the compressor, life of the motors, the actuators, handful of other components. They did the due diligence to get it down to failure mechanisms. It wasn't just we replaced 10 things and that we count them all as failures. They had really decent data stream back from their failures. And that served them very well. And so if they changed models of compressors, they could do a comparative study, which is a whole lot more efficient than testing it to characterize the life of a new component. And they used all of their history data for everything else in their system that was going to be the same or very similar. And as somebody mentioned earlier, there's still assumptions on that. If you change the box or you change some elements of it, there may be interactions that we don't take account of. Yeah, and Michael's exactly right. Returns are almost always underreported. Now, I find that the more expensive a product is, the more likely somebody's going to complain about it. If my mechanical pen on my desk fails, I don't even know what brand it is. Maybe it's a good sign that the brand logo on it is worn off over you through use. Yet I probably would just go buy another pen and not really pay too much attention to the brand. I just throw it away and go get another one. Whereas if it's my laptop, I'll probably go get it repaired. And if it's lasted long enough, I'd buy the same brand again. Yet it's the when vehicles fail, now with all the telemetry built into so many vehicles, they're getting better and better data. I know that it's always difficult with any industry to get it. It's not the best. It's more, it's, as my English teacher would roll her eyes, it's more better than not having data. I run into a couple industries that get absolutely nothing back from the field. But yeah, spare parts is a good way to look at it. Lots of ways to go about doing it. The hard part for most of us is that if you're designing something new or you're in a startup and don't have history data, you don't have shipping products, or you're bringing in a new technology or something like that, we still get asked that question: how long will this last? Or if we're moving into a new environment, how long will this last in that environment? So some of these techniques that you're mentioning here would work. They're all ways for us to chip away at that understanding of how long this product will last. And some are better than others at doing this. Yeah, having data, having test data, having field data is a great place to start, and to make sure you have good access to it. And the better we do failure analysis on it, the better. Let's see, Jersey's talking about, how do you define life if each unit of your product will fail at a different point in time due to the presence of random hand of failure? Yeah. Well, part of it is that's why I like a distribution, is that's that getting a sense of how does that random hand distribute the times the failures for individual products. Now, for some products, and I worked with one team that made tape drives, and they were, this is a long time ago, but they were tape drives, so doing backups, I think is what they were meant to be doing. And they knew the physics of this type of tape they were using to make the read-write tape they were using had a certain abrasiveness that eroded the glass fret that was over the head of the reader or writer type device, whatever they had probably a better name for it. And once it wore that fret, that glass barrier, by I think it was like a millimeter or even less, then it was too close to the read-write head and it lost its ability to do its job efficiently, and it would fail. The system would not be able to read and write as efficiently or as well. It had too many errors, and then it would be have to be replaced. And they knew it per foot of tape that went over the head. And so they knew if you were using this 24/7 and the tape was consistently moving, they knew pretty closely, given the variability of how thick that glass was, which was fairly precise, and the particular tapes that you're using and how specifically abrasive they were, which was controlled pretty well, they knew to within a week or two, say a few hundred hours of when it would fail. Now, we've seen that in other things where you have wear and you can measure the wear. I worked on with a team that did maintenance for escalators in a public transit system. And one of the most expensive failure mechanisms was due to the nature of the design of these escalators. They had a large chain that was connected to the steps and it moved the whole set around. And chains stretch when they're under tension. And eventually they stretch too much. Then it becomes a safety hazard because the gap between the steps on that escalator expand a bit. And now you could get caught in that. At some point it becomes dangerous. And so the maintenance team would always check that gap, which is a surrogate for the chain stretch. And then they would say, all right, this one is getting close. In the next 6 months or so, it'll be unsafe. And they would initiate the major repair of replacing that chain. They take all the steps off, replace the chain, connect all the steps back to it, and then that gap would be as factory new, basically bring it right back. And so there's some things we can predict fairly well, or we can monitor fairly well and take action related to that. Other things, they happen so fast, or they happen in a way that we don't monitor or measure. They have, say, corrosion on a circuit board within your laptop. It may take it months and months to go. And if you knew it was there, you could take steps to mitigate it. Yet we often don't. I don't examine the inside of my iPhone very often. In fact, never, because I've seen what's inside that, and I don't want to have to try to put it back together and get it working. So lots of ways you've brought it up. I've used a good number of those. I've used spare parts as a way to go after it. First, knowing that we didn't use shotgun replacements. If somebody, you really knew what it needed to replace before you got the spares up. So the number one way, by far, and we do it every day, and engineers do this on a regular basis, is we just guess. And yes, it's uncertain. And you might call it engineering judgment and saying, yes, we don't expect this solid state electrolytic capacitor to fail anytime soon in this application. And you're probably right. And other times, because of the load, because of its location, because of something else, we may say, you know, that may be a problem. We need to investigate it. And you probably are right. We're actually pretty good based on our experience. And with a group of people, like a good, well-run FMEA, we can do pretty darn good at sorting out what's the highest priorities, what are the things most likely to fail. And we need better information on that, and which things we really don't need to worry about. Now, we get surprised from time to time. That's why there's all these other methods out there. Yet, don't underestimate the power of just guessing. And it gives us a basis to be surprised if it's different, and there's other techniques into it. Now, when it's important, and your primary method is to use engineering judgment or experience, there's a technique called the Delphi method. And to describe it just quickly is, let's say you have 10 people that have some familiarity with, say, the way this box can fail, or that this technology may be of a problem. And you ask them, so how long will it last without failure in this application, this environment, and so on? Give them a specific question, get a number is what you need. What's the minimum time it'll last without failure, or whatever is relevant for your analysis? And you'll get a range of numbers. And so go back to the highest number, the one that said it'll last 30 years, and the one that said it will last 30 seconds, and ask them what information they're using or what experience they're using to form that response. Share that with the rest of the group and ask them to update their response. And what happens after two, three cycles of that with sharing the high and low information of why that person decided to go with it, the group will tend to coalesce on a very tight estimate. And it's by adding the information of the outliers that sometimes you get the insights of failure mechanisms or of experience that others just don't have. And so it helps consolidate that estimate pretty quickly. So if you really have an important one and you want to really get after this thing, take a look at what the Delphi method is for getting expert opinions and estimates. It may be a helpful technique for you. But we do something similar in FMEA, and it allows us to focus in on things that we may need to get a better answer later, or it's good enough, and it helps us focus on where we should go. One of my favorite questions is ask the design engineers, what keeps you up at night? Where do you think it's going to fail first? Where do we have the least margin? Those kinds of questions can expose areas of concern based on their experience. It's a guess, technically, yet it's usually pretty darn good. Vendor data, use your supplier data. You need to really ask a couple of questions first, because if they're doing parts count prediction, or if they're doing, you throw it in a chamber and hope it works, or they're using a handful of standards, they list all these things that really aren't accelerated testing, and they have no basis for saying over the last 5 years or 10 years or 100 years, you need to understand how they arrive at their estimates. And some vendors do a really good job. They will give you, if you ask or take a look for it, and I've run into a handful of vendors that do this, is they will do the detailed accelerated testing or even physics of failure style of evaluations and studies and publish it and say, here's, if you use this in a high frequency scenario, this IGBT will follow this failure mechanism or will be susceptible to this failure mechanism, and here's the distribution, and you can adjust it for what stress you're going to apply it to. Or if you're using it in low frequencies, here it's a different failure mechanism, and here's the research and distributions that relate to that, and you could adjust it to your application. And they are gold, the vendors that do that. So really, really appreciate them. And Dan's asking, so if ever tested a part that wound up performing much better than the vendor said it would. Yep, definitely. And mostly I think it was the sales guy-ish influence that they wanted us to buy a more robust product, but the one they were offering, from our understanding and experience, would work just fine. And it did. It worked. It wasn't an issue at all. Yet others, saying it will last 200 years. And they sent us, or there was one of them, we actually were evaluating a new package from Intel. And 29 of the 30 samples failed in a very early in the tests we were doing for the how this joint, the solder joint, would work. And it was a great answer from Intel, says, well, it was a random sample so that you got unlucky and got 29 out of 30 that had, were going to fail early. Like, what's the chance of that? Well, that's a whole nother discussion. But I've had both experiences where products work better than we expected. And even with upgrading some components and electronics, you can run it above its rated value, do it with eyes open and understanding exactly how the stresses you're applying are going to work on it. But they will survive. They will work. I've worked with oil and gas industry where they're putting a whole bunch of electronics right behind the drill bit on an oil ex a drilling operation. It was amazing any of it worked. And it would work for hours and hours and hours, which was totally baffling to me. Yet they were able to provide a function to steer these rotary heads and do chemical sampling and all kinds of cool stuff. So some products are just amazing that they work, and they work very well over long times when you really don't expect them to. And I see it all the time in halt testing. Is mostly electronics. You put the box in the vibration table and accelerate vibration and temperatures and all this stuff. And the design team engineer sitting there with you, and they saying, there's no way it's going to work at 80 degrees C. And we get to 110 degrees C before we see any indication that it's not performing like it should. They're literally shocked. And it's, yeah, it won't last forever at those elevated temperatures, yet it will operate. And in some cases, depending on the technology, it will operate a really long time. So, yeah, you can go over stress or over the vendor's claims or get answers from them that are conservative or for all kinds of different reasons, or they'll be just the opposite. So it's really focus in how do you know how will it fail in our application? What is likely to fail in our application? And then what's your assumptions or your supporting information? How do you know that answer? And if they can give you the physics and chemistry and so on, and here's the mechanism, here's how this stress applies to it, here's our studies on it, you can be, if you would have done the tests and used that much rigor, then I suspect you can trust that data set. if they say, well, just trust us, we've shipped 100 of them and none of them come back yet. Well, you only shipped them yesterday here, you know. So give it a minute to get off the truck. I've had that happen too. So vendor data comes in lots and lots of forms. The more you probe into it and get the good engineer-to-engineer discussions, the better you can trust it. Simulations. One of my favorites was finite element analysis for drop testing. We didn't even have prototypes yet. We're still in early design. We had the components, the structure of it designed, but we didn't know how the circuit board would react to a shock. And so we did finite element analysis and simulated a shock loading on the system and where would it go. And it was dead on when the engineering team did not believe the finite element modeling until we got prototypes, went to the lab, and it failed exactly as the modeling suggested it would. And they were dumbfounded. And I think they became advocates of using finite element in the future for all kinds of different things. The other way I've used finite element is to used the age state of your systems. So we know that electronics are not finite element, but electrical modeling, SPICE modeling, as I used to call it, is that let's say we know that our capacitance is going to drift for certain technologies or capacitors. Let's simulate that we have an aged set of components, that they're instead of a like a resistor being at 100 ohms, it's now at 70 ohms. Will our circuit still work when we have that much of a change over time of these electrical components' values, the performance? And it's a way to say, well, we know the degradation of these features of our subsystems. Will it still work over time? And we can use various types of modeling tools to simulate that. Now, thermal modeling and stuff like that. Is this fan have enough capacity or too much backflow? How much backflow or back pressure can we put on this fan or how do we optimize that so that we get the most airflow with the least amount of stress to the fans and its bearings? And we can do a bunch of things like that to really get an understanding of how the stresses either behave or perform, or what's likely to fail, or where the stress concentrations are, and on and on. It gives a insight to improve our guessing, our engineering knowledge. It also gives us insights of how then to focus on where the margins are. How much margin do we have? Do we need to do an accelerated test, for example, or some other demonstration style test? So simulations are a great set of tools for us to use early in a program, especially to get a really good understanding of where the risks are. All right, a couple more approaches here. This one, I've talked about it at length in other webinars, and we write about it a lot on Ascendo, but we do a lot of testing. Now, I don't really jump to testing right away. It's expensive, and sometimes it takes a long time. Sometimes we have no other option. It's the only way we're going to get this information, or it's in the contract, like demonstration testing, or various ways for us to go after this. But the basic idea is that testing is for life estimation is really, really limited to, well, can we test it in real life conditions over a duration that simulates a lifetime, that is a lifetime? So let's take a new vehicle and drive it through all kinds of different environments, or drive it through just only in the high desert year round, and evaluate it and run it and test it for years. Or we know that we have a helicopter that so many flight hours is our goal. So let's go fly it for that many hours and see what happens. And sometimes these demos can be risky. Not only for catastrophic failures, but is that one unit representative of your production? There's all kinds of issues with that. So Let's see. Oh, I see a question came in. Oh, I never knew that. I haven't seen a wind turbine blade painted one color. Was that in one of my drawings? It's a reduced bird strikes on blades. I had no idea. I'll have to look into that. But the idea of testing, if some products lend themselves that you can do it in real time for a relatively short life and you get good information about it. And it's more of a sampling problem, is how representative will that be for your overall estimate of its life. Other times we do life testing where we use, and I, the difference between life testing and accelerated life testing is just, do you have a transfer function that says, if I run it over stress, I can translate the results back to normal stress? But if I can stress it at normal conditions, just use the unused time frame. I'm thinking of a toaster or a door latch or a laptop hinge, for example. Those kinds of things we can accelerate just by using them more often. And it's an easy transfer function in those cases, if it's done well. But each step that we go from real life, real set of stresses to select stresses on a subsystem or a component or on a particular aspect of the product to accelerated test, we're testing where we're usually focused on a specific mechanism and under accelerated or elevated stresses of some sort. We step away further and further from how the customer is going to use the product. And hence, there's more and more uncertainty. Does this really apply to the way the customer uses it? And so we have to be more and more careful and think through exactly how we're using testing to evaluate how a product is going to fail and when it's going to fail, with the ideas to estimate the life of it. We do this on all the various elements and components and subsystems of our products. And we get all kinds of great information from these things, yet it really is just a sample, right? The more we know about how it will fail, what mechanisms are at play, all of those aspects of it really help us to focus the testing on where we really need to get answers. And the more focused we are, the more we understand the mechanisms at play, the better our results are going to be. So it's kind of a catch-22. You need to know how long and what's going to fail before you go in to do testing. And we don't always have that. So there are going to be assumptions. And then modeling is a technique that we use. And what I like about this approach is even a simple block diagram or a fault tree. And there's software packages out there, variety of different sources and places to do it. And you can even use Excel to some degrees. So let's say you put in the power supply, we got great vendor data, and our screens and keyboards that we're using for our computer system, we have great field data on those. So we'll use that information for those blocks. And we're using a brand new widget for this part of the system, and we're just going to guess right now for that. And you can populate those block diagrams, run the math out, and get a reasonable estimate. Now, what I find is the greatest use of this is not just to get a one-time estimate and say you're done, is to take a look at two parts of a simple model like this, where you're pulling variety of different sources of information. Everything from testing to modeling to physics of failure to whatever, the field data and estimates are just guesses, is we can get a system level estimate of the life pretty early. And we know that it's pretty vague. There's lots of uncertainty in big parts of this thing. But which ones either have the most uncertainty related to it, which is the weakest in the precision of its estimate? That's an area to go focus on if it's important, if it's an area that's likely to fail or cause a shortening of the life versus other parts of your system, or it's the weakest link. I think I've used this story a handful of times in other presentations, but one of the best uses of a simple block diagram was for a workstation, and they broke it down to the different teams that were working. There was a team working on procuring a hard drive, and another team designing the motherboard, and the CPU is another part, and so on. And so the model just reflected the various teams and engineering talent that was using to put this system together. And Phil went around and asked, "What's your estimate today of what's the reliability of this, and how well do you know that estimate? What's your evidence?" And at first, it was absolute just straight guess, very early in the program. And the program manager said, "Oh, this is interesting. So let's take a look at the weakest link. Go get a better estimate. Give us some options to make this a better estimate and or a more reliable element of the system." And every week, they took a look at updating their estimates from across the development team. And every week, they focused in on the one that was the weakest link, because it was obviously a series system. And that's where they invested improving the estimates. And sometimes it involved getting better designs, getting better products, getting more robust solutions. And other times it just meant getting a better estimate. And so eventually some of the components and elements of the system went into some form of testing. And others used really good field data and did better failure analysis on the power supplies that they had in previous units, for example, and got a really decent estimate from it. But that was the use of the model. It wasn't one time. They updated it every week through the development process, and it guided their decisions to allocate resources to where to focus to improve the reliability of their system, meanwhile, improving their overall estimate of the system reliability. So it was a very clever, useful way to use a simple block diagram. That's a great technique that we have available to us. And then physics of failure. It is a great tool if it applies to your technology. If there's an existing model out there that a handful of grad students spent 2 years developing for you. The literature has a bunch of models available. If it's your material in your application, you have to be pretty careful about which models you apply and how well you understand that phenomena in your application. So it comes with caveats. It's not a panacea from not ever doing it. Now, basic FR4 circuit boards with off-the-shelf components, it works pretty well. It takes care of, I'd say, 90% of the different dominant failure mechanisms. Thermal cycling, flex, electrical loading, all kinds of cool stuff, thermal loading. It does a pretty decent job of highlighting areas that are not quite as robust as you thought, or areas that are pretty good. And it gives you a pretty decent estimate. Will it survive for some period of time? What probability will it go that far? Yet it doesn't always cover all the failure mechanisms. I haven't run into a physics of failure model that handles forklift damage yet, the likelihood of that occurring. So if you're designing something brand new and using a brand new material, it's likely not a good physics of failure model for your application, for your material. Now, you could go develop it. If it's really important to you, go sort it out. But it does take time to get a really good model. And once you have it, it's great. And as long as you don't change your technology or the materials or your processing, outside of the model, then it's still useful for you. So it might be a one-time use it for years kind of approach. Let's see. Jersey's asking, how would people here go about verifying, validating a damage model that you have not developed? Well, that's a good question. That goes back to, it's not quite physics of failure, but I'm thinking of Black's, I think it's Black's equation, where it was temperature humidity for the integrity of epoxy over molded components. The easy way is to say, well, what kind of failures are you getting from the field, and were they related to that failure mechanism, to that damage model? And that takes time, and it's in the field. Other times is run an accelerated test on your own design techniques or models or materials, comparing it to that model. It's an efficient accelerated test approach when you have a standard you're comparing against, because you can tell if you're failing sooner than expected or later than expected fairly quickly in many cases. Just redo the study on your own. So yeah, Peck's model. Thanks, David. I was not sure it was Black's model. That's a different one. But the idea is that with a little bit of focus and understanding of the mechanisms at play, the literature around physics of failure or various damage models allows you to do a shortcut. Instead of recreating all of this information on your own, is use those that literature, the previous work and testing as a way to streamline the testing or data analysis that you're going to do yourself. So there's a couple of ways to approach that. And thanks. Yeah, Black's model is electromigration. I always loved the failure analysis images of electromigration. Such metal does such beautiful things. It's not particularly useful for your circuit and for your system, but it does look pretty cool. So these are just I think I talked about six different approaches in here, and I think the folks here listed a handful of others when I asked you what do you do. But the bottom line is it working for you? Is it providing reasonable information for your team to make good decisions? And if not, start looking at some of the other methods, start looking at some of the other approaches, and find out what will improve the ability for you to inform your team of what works and what doesn't work, or how your product's going to survive over some duration or not. So, not a good way to estimate beta values for a product with a novel product with little field experience. Well, you got to understand how it fails. What's the failure mechanism? And sometimes there's literature about, say, a capacitor. Big electrolytic capacitors have a viable beta value of like 6 or 7. Whereas bearings, if you're using bearings, and that's expected to be your dominant failure mechanism, more likely a 2 or a 3 on a viable distribution. But if you really need to understand what's that value, well, run to failure. Run an accelerated life test and run to failure. Get your own beta values. If it's not in literature, if your system is so novel that it's not in the literature anywhere, or nobody's talking about it anyway, yeah, then you're going to have to do it yourself. I guess if you fully understand the failure mechanism, if you know how it's going to fail, if it's a wear system or a corrosion system, or what's the underlying physics chemistry, may give you some clues of where to look and how to set up and run an accelerated life test. But yeah, at some point, some of these questions, you just have to break out the lab and run some samples and get some test data, run to failure. Yeah, Carl's exactly right. We don't live in a perfect world. Although there was a poem by Oliver Wendell Holmes called The One Hoss Shay that this deacon designed a product or a horse carriage, a single horse carriage, that every part of the system was as strong as every other part. And so it lasted 100 years and a day. And every single element of that shay failed exactly at the same time. And so that was a perfect design. But that was in a poem from what, 200 years ago. All right, thanks, Laura, for joining. And do rethink using published external data. If you've got good internal data, double check it. Make sure you got good systems going there. Let's see, a handful of other comments here. Few people are heading out already. Right. And my system actually survived. This lung hasn't failed yet. So let me stop the recording. Thanks to everybody for joining today. And I'll stay in the line if it lets me to see if there's any questions that anybody has.